for peace, that until we turn around the aggressive U.S. foreign policy and that seeks full spectrum dominance in every part of the globe with 850 military bases compared to 2 foreign bases for China and 5 for Russia. Until we turn that policy around, we have little chance of getting rid of nuclear weapons and reducing the risk of nuclear war. So we see all these things connected. And I'm going to be out tomorrow morning at the Israeli consulate from 10:30 to 12:30 every Friday. Now there are people out there making a whole lot of noise at the Israeli consulate, 465 Montgomery Street. Hope to see some of you there.
Beautiful. That really puts it together with that first story we did about the fact that through this civilian airport in Oakland, major parts are being shipped for those F-35. They're pretty dangerous planes, aren't they, those F-35s?
Yes. Yeah, and Veterans for Peace is part of the People's Arms Alliance embargo that's been going out to Travis Air Force Base, but we're going to be very interested in joining with the Oakland People's Arms Embargo, and now that we know that all these weapons are being shipped out of Oakland, that's serious stuff. We'll be there.
Beautiful. Thanks for all the great work that you do with the Vets for Peace. We're obviously going to continue this dialogue. Thanks for joining us today, Jerry Condon, Veterans for Peace. Stay tuned. You're absolutely welcome. Stay tuned, everybody.
That does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Estás escuchando KBOO Portland.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
One, two, three, four.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. In the aftermath of the big, and I call it ugly, bill that was passed and put into law, we saw probably one of the biggest transfers of wealth this country has ever seen. And with that transfer has spawned a lot of conversations about our relationship with money. Some people are reexamining their understanding of capitalism. What does that mean in the age of a billionaire class? I mean, here in San Francisco, we got not one, not two, but 85 billionaires living in the city of San Francisco. That's not the whole Bay Area. And so things have changed remarkably when we talk about the economic landscape. And there's a sister here. Malaika is the former senior news and politics editor of Essence Magazine. Her writing has appeared in The Root, Teen Vogue, New Republic, and The Guardian, where she was a columnist. She received her law degree from Columbia Law School, where she served as the articles editor for the Columbia Journal of Race and Law. And prior to law school, she received her MS from the Columbia School of Social Work. Her name is Malaika Jabali. And you have a book out, and the book is called No, It's Not Capitalism. No, It's Not You, It's Capitalism. And you start off and frame it in a way that's very interesting, but I think it's very poignant. And I'm surprised more people haven't really positioned it this way, where you look at capitalism as an actual relationship. And maybe you can build on that a little bit and talk about it, because you start off with talking about breaking up with capitalism.
Yeah, I had the idea during the pandemic for the book, It's Not You, It's Capitalism, as a response to what I was seeing online. I was on social media and I found that so many people were blaming themselves for what was happening during a global crisis. So even with something that is largely out of the hands of everyday people, we still couldn't find a way to think systematically. It was, well, if you got laid off during the pandemic and you're not making enough money, this was still 2021, 2022. We're still feeling the after effects of a pandemic, and people are internalizing their own fallibility. They're internalizing why they're not able to work multiple jobs to pay their rent. They're internalizing why the cost of living has gone up. They're internalizing why they can't afford rent and why wages aren't increasing. And so I saw a brother who was talking about feeling frustrated by all of that. And there tends to be a culture within us as Americans where we don't even want to offer sympathy to people who aren't doing well and who are suffering under capitalism. So I said out loud when I was reading this tweet, it's not you, it's capitalism. And so that inspired the title and the themes that are present throughout the book. And even before I came up with the title, I'd written maybe half, if not most of the book by then. I'd had a first draft done, and I completely rearranged it, or I should say repurposed it a little bit to dive deeper into the relationship metaphor. But even in those very early drafts, there were a couple of references to toxic relationships because it just felt the most appropriate, where we know we are giving and giving and giving, and the system is taking the way that some relationships can be for us.
As you were talking, I kept thinking about, you know, growing up at a time where men, you know, us as men, we defined ourselves by a few things, and one of them was jobs. And I remember when my pops lost his job, there was a lot of depression, there was a lot of guilt, there was a lot of blaming, you know, a lot of things like that. And so I think a lot of men had grown up believing, you know, associating their worth with their jobs. Has that notion expanded to women and everybody else, or has that relationship always been there with everybody? And now you're just maybe looking at it becoming a little bit more toxic? Or is this something that is brand new as far as you're concerned?
I think the gender norms around making money and being productive, probably here in the US and elsewhere, is a defining trait, is something that I think was distinctive to sort of pull out and draw inspiration from. Is the fact that I've been doing a lot of reporting in the Midwest where you had a lot of industry, and men, Black men in particular, were concentrated in those industries. And without that, there is a sense of, I'm not doing something right as a man, not just as an American, where it has become practically patriotic to, you know, have a job and be a hustler and, you know, be a small business owner and be enterprising. So it's not just you are, you know, in some ways a lesser citizen or a less productive member of society, but you're not fully male. You're not completely fulfilling your manhood. I think where it comes into play with women at times is there has been a wave of feminism that associated being active in the workplace and being a girl boss, if we consider, you know, more modern iterations of feminism, being a girl boss and having your own and being independent. And those are all, I think it's valuable, obviously, to be able to feel like there's dignity with your work and you can provide for yourself. But the lack of the inability to do that doesn't mean that we are lesser people. doesn't mean that we're less smart. As somebody like myself who values work and education, both of my parents were public school teachers, I value being ambitious, and you do the right things, you're supposed to get the right outputs, you put the right inputs of school, you're supposed to have the 401k and the solid job. And my career has had, you know, it's been a bit of a cycle and ups and downs, and that should be okay. But unfortunately, we live in a world where we are not really taught how to navigate a system and how to work collectively when those things aren't happening for us, when we're doing, quote unquote, everything right.
You know, when I think about the emotion aspect of relationships, you spell this out in the book, you talk about it being toxic, you talk about the notion of gaslighting, all these different things that if we're having conversations about relationships, I think it becomes very clear for people. Can you kind of build on that a little bit more, like the gaslighting aspect?
Yes, and I don't want the psychologists or psychiatrists in the chat, in the listening audience to be offended, because I don't, you know, I'm not a therapist. So this was intended as a self-help book to address a systemic problem. So I don't have the most accurate definition of gaslighting, but I do know what toxicity can be. And one of those things, whether it's officially, you know, would this be considered gaslighting or not, but is us being convinced that there really aren't other alternatives, that mm-hmm. this is the only way we have to live, that human beings' natural function is to be individualistic, that there has not been, that there have not been societies and communities where people were actually empathetic and collective and worked together. We really start history with this Western idea of individualism, and we don't really appreciate the full scope of ways that people have interacted and lived with each other, even within the United States. Like, we don't mm-hmm. recognize the kinds of socialist ideas, policy, utopian kinds of communities, Black liberation theology, speaking of prosperity gospel, the extent of Black liberation theology, which is what I grew up in, where mm-hmm. I was, we revered, we believed it was practically irreverent to be individualistic and to not care for your neighbor and to not think about collective justice for Black people. And so this idea that this is the only way to live, I think, is the main myth. You know, whether we call it a gaslight or a myth or a pathology or whatever, that is what is driving, I think, a lot of this, because we don't recognize not only that we have had socialism in some ways, you know, because people can argue what it actually is, and that could be another topic later in the conversation, but what socialism actually is, but there have been iterations of socialisms where we had mayors and congresspeople and state representatives in the state of Wisconsin, where I have spent a lot of my years, who said, you know, we have got too much power in the hands of these multimillionaires. So let's make sure that we're not commodifying everything. We don't need to commodify every piece of land. So let's build parks, let's build green space. So we've had these other ways of thinking right here in the States. And yet over the last 40, 50, maybe 60 years, so much of that has been eliminated from, I mean, I don't know if it's ever really been in our public education that we've taught students that this, that these were the kinds of ideas that we've had in this country. So if it ever did exist, we definitely have not seen it. And even something as simple as saying, can we just have universal healthcare? We've been talking about universal healthcare for about, I'm doing the math here, I'm not a math person, I'm an English major, I want to say since the 1920s, so about a century now. And so these are not, a lot of these are not even new ideas, but mm-hmm. we have been convinced that there is no other way of being, the same way an abusive partner might tell you, there's nothing better for you out there. I know I'm treating you like trash. I know that, you know, this may not be ideal, but are you really going to do better than me? Like, who are you? You know, so that's the overarching theme.
Well, we can call it gaslighting, toxic relationship, but that last example is what I grew up knowing as pimping. Mm. You know, except it's big pimping.
That's,
you know,
right.
And it's toxic all the way around, because it's, you know, as I remember a pimp once saying, I'm going to tell you the sky is green, you know, and you're going to say, no, it's blue. And it's like, I just have to focus you yet. You know, I haven't focused you yet so that you understand it's green. And I think that's the American way of doing things, convincing us that we should be privileged to work at this factory and get $2 an hour. It's the American dream. And, you know, and I guess, you know, the American dream seems deeply embedded in that, that pimpology, if you will, of, you know, having us believe like if I just work hard enough, I can get there. So let me ask you this, because you mentioned individualism and you also talked about socialism. So I don't know if my definition of socialism applies, but we're told to go out and do it on your own. And I look around and I'm like, huh, Elon Musk didn't do it on his own. He got all this money from his pops, $300 million to start up his company. And Trump didn't do it on his own. He inherited a bunch of things. And I'm looking at all these folks that I know that have a lot of money. And many of them got that money handed down. It was trickled down. Resources were given to them. Yet we're made to feel like you're my enemy. So if Malaika is sitting next to me in the classroom, can't really help you with anything because I got to get mine, you go get yours. And we're being convinced to do the individualism while many of these billionaire types are working behind the scenes and sharing resources and everything. Am I understanding that correctly? That's how I've seen it. So it seems like they're practicing socialism while we're told to be individualistic.
They are practicing a form of collective power and control. And I think your instinct there in terms of collectivity is at the root of socialism. There are a lot of different ways that people would describe it. I would say it's about workers having power and control of where and how they work. Mm-hmm. So and how an enterprise makes money and how those wages are distributed. So a good way of thinking about it, I think, comes from Marxist economist Richard Wolff out of the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, formerly there, but renowned Marxist economist. And he talks about how our workplaces are dictatorships, even though we live in a democratic society. So if we have proffered democracy as an ideal way of governance, why do we allow dictatorships where we work? And you've got the CEOs, you've got the folks on these boards of directors, these corporate boards who are deciding their decisions together. But I think what is distinctive, that's not socialism just because they're working together. It is capitalism because they're exploiting the wages, they're exploiting the labor of a mass group of workers, and they're a minority. So that is a distinctive aspect of capitalism. You've had market economies before capitalism. We have had trade and we've had merchants. We've had folks selling their wares. You know, we've had people buying and selling land before capitalism. But what's distinctive about capitalism is that those CEOs are a handful of people, relatively speaking, to the global population. They're a minority, and they're a minority intentionally. Their whole purpose is to exploit the labor of masses and masses of people. So akin to what Sada Shakur has said in her autobiography, who I quote, and I quote a lot of other revolutionaries, because I wanted revolutionaries of color specifically, because I wanted us to realize this is not foreign to Black people. This is innate in a lot of our liberatory work, is thinking collectively. And so in her autobiography, she talks about the fact that a number of African countries did not realize they weren't fighting for capitalism. They were fighting to have socialist societies. So when we think about the 1960s, a lot of those independence movements, those African independence movements, it was rooted in collective liberation. It was rooted in socialism. And so she says, if bosses can, you know, make the decisions and they're the ones who are using our labor to make money, why can't workers have that power? That's the essential contrast between capitalism and socialism. And we I think a lot of people would align with that. Like, why can't workers have the decision-making power? Why can't we have management decisions? Why can't we own the resources? Why can't we own what we produce? That's really what we are villainizing, is workers having power, which is absolutely nuts.
Yeah, definitely workers are being villainized. You know, I mean, just looking at the way that people describe unions, as if there's some sort of pariah, and neither black folks, you know, right here in Oakland that I see doing that, you know, like, oh, it's the unions, it's the unions. Like, you should be happy these unions are fighting for workers' rights, but in their mind, it's like somehow they've ruined everything. And we're talking about mostly black folks in these unions. So it's it's interesting to see that sort of twist. But this comes down to a couple of things. One, in the book, as you mentioned, you highlight revolutionaries and their take on capitalism. And maybe you could share with us some of the people you highlight, because you have these nice graphics and, you know, you can give props out to your artists, but you have Kathleen Cleaver, Nick Estes, Dolores Huerta, Martin Luther King. And, you know, we know these names, but we don't always fully understand their positions on capitalism. And they're the gauntlet from a Black Panther on down to Martin Luther King. So maybe you can share with us some of that and why it was important for us to see these figures speak about capitalism.
Yes, and you mentioned our illustrator and designer, Kayla E., who did the graphics. We really wanted this to be very visual. I wanted to appeal to younger generations as a relatively younger generation. I'm an elder millennial. So I gained my perspective on capitalism, I think, through the unique perspective of being a millennial who was coming of age during the Great Recession and young enough where I didn't quite have the, I think, the bias against the Soviet Republic with the fall of the Berlin Wall. What I saw was the fall of Wall Street. What I saw was the exploitation of Black and brown potential homeowners. My family was a victim of that. So we wanted.
You're talking about 2008.
2008, 2009.
Yeah,
the age of Obama.
Yeah,
I graduated from grad school after having studied the Great Recession in grad school, finding it very difficult to get a job. So that was my association with capitalism, was all the ways that it has harmed us. So I wanted, this is just an aside, but I wanted to shout out Kayla E. for doing those illustrations, because we wanted to appeal to millennials and younger generations who might feel a little bit more inclined to align with some of the ideas and values behind it. And along with that was, this is not just a white thing. I was in New York for most of my adult life, post-graduation. And people just assume this was something in coastal cities, that this is just something for elite white people. This is something for hippies who, you know, don't want to work. All these stereotypes that are associated with left politics. And I was like, no, there's Ella Baker. There's Martin Luther King. There's Malcolm X. All these people who have been explicit in their critiques of capitalism. Obviously, in the birthplace in Oakland, the Black Panther Party, they were explicitly anti-capitalist and revolutionary. I'm trying to say Million Man March, but we're going way before that. The March on Washington was inspired and led by the work of Bayard Rustin and
Philip Randolph.
Yes, thank you.
Philip Randolph. Yeah, he was the one that kicked that off.
Yes, and so I feature them as well and talk about their history, because it was initially the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. So it was always connected.
And not to cut you off,
please.
Martin Luther King's initial speech, because we know him as I Have a Dream, right? And that wasn't planned. He flipped the script midway through, because he's talking about a promissory note. He's talking about money that's due to us. He's talking about exploitative labor. So he's on one when he's that speech. And people like to forget about that because they're like, you know, we're all standing under the sun, kumbaya, and the whole nine. It's like, did you listen to that speech? Because He was like, where's my money? He might as well have just said it that way.
Exactly. You know, he was thinking it, though.
No, he literally said, you know, we got a check, a promissory note.
That's right.
That we didn't get. I mean, I don't know how much more explicit you can be for those times.
It's precisely. And that march, that protest movement was explicitly about economic justice.
Yes.
But it has been reframed. Speaking of ways that our history has been whitewashed and erased from our curricula, it was explicit about making those kinds of demands. And coming from two socialist organizers, you know, it was going to have a certain political and ideological bent to it. But we never talk about that because we always want to talk about white kids and black kids holding hands and from Stone Mountain, which is where I grew up. You know, so he shouts out this area of Georgia. And that's all we think about is kind of voting rights, because that's what's most palatable for the powers that be that that shape our curricula. Mm-hmm. So there are so many black people who aligned with this kind of thinking. And even historically, our Western African societies were rooted in collectivity. So this idea that this is just some foreign or a white concept is completely divorced from reality.
Right. And I think that's part of the gaslighting, which leads me to my next question. I like to use this word celebrity capitalism, if I may. And I think about how we're often, again, I'll use the word gaslight, because they'll show us Oprah and Tyler Perry and say, these are billionaires and you too can be like that. And then they show us the Jay-Z's and Beyonce's and they're billionaires. And I turn on TV and BET, you know, doesn't necessarily have you on breaking the stuff down, but they sure are going to show you the billionaire's brunch, you know, with Dr. Dre and whoever else. Are billionaires, right?
They love a brunch.
Yeah. So we're sitting there at home going, well, you know, this dude came from the projects, came from Marcy. I'm from Soundview. Maybe I can make it. You know what I'm saying? That's the type of thing. In my mind, it's a reinforcement of the American dream. But if I'm looking historically at the height of the Black Panthers and SNCC, when they were all talking about socialism and taking a very, you know, distinct anti-capitalist stance, you had James Brown and Lionel Hampton and all these black celebrities that were coalescing around Richard Nixon talking about green power. Remember James Brown, he's on tape. He's like, black power is green power, brother. You know, and then they were endorsing Richard Nixon and they were talking about black capitalism. And today we might see our Killer Mikes and other folks like that who are talking about, let's get our money in these banks and black capitalism. So how do you kind of navigate that when we have some of these luminaries that you quoted that talk about the harms of capitalism? You wrote a whole book that breaks this down, but then I'm seeing Killer Mike and everybody saying black capitalism, and that's an echo from James Brown and all of them on up. So how do we deal with that and make sense of it?
That's a great and confounding question. As a black woman who grew up in the black Mecca, probably the heart of black capitalism, Atlanta, Georgia, is the bougie black Mecca.
Oh, so you in Atlanta. Let me sit back. You got something to say about this, because that's where it's all born. I'm going to pick up my coffee and put my popcorn in and go have at it, sister.
On that one. And I was raised in that culture where we just assumed that by just the nature of enough black people going to good schools, going to the Spelmans and the Morehouses and being examples or models in a capitalist society and rising the ranks of the corporate ladder, that in itself was liberation, that was enough, that just ascending to excellence was the equivalent of freedom. And it's not. So being able, however, to advise our people, or at least raise our awareness and make us more aware of history as to why that is probably a misconception, is a knotty task. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do that, I think, on a mass scale. But what we can do is just look at the reality. As far advanced as Atlanta might seem, it also leads the country in income inequality. We think of Atlanta as a Black Mecca. The Black population has steadily declined over the last 20 years, really since the Olympics, so about 30 years, to right now, Atlanta's not even a Black majority city. Atlanta is a Black plurality, but we're no longer over 50%. And that's there's a reason for that. There's policy reasons for that, because when you continue to buy into this myth that capitalism will save us, and that Black capitalism especially is the saving grace for Black people as a whole, that we only need to have individual economic success, we're led to the reality that we're facing right now, where in Atlanta, you've got all these extended stay motels, because instead of actually getting rid of homelessness and poverty, we've just redistributed to the suburbs. So I'll give you a specific example. I grew up on the east side. I mentioned Stone Mountain. That's an eastern suburb just outside of the city of Atlanta. And when I was growing up, just a regular, diverse, working class city. But the lack of policy planning to actually want to address the root causes of inequality and the homelessness crisis that we have seen has led to a number of people whose homes have been dismantled because they wanted to put in market housing, luxury housing. We didn't have enough policy people to say, well, maybe we should put a halt to all this quote unquote development if it's not actually genuinely affordable. So I saw my neighborhood transform, where up and down the block now, you have seen homeless shelters really be replaced by these really predatory housing commodities. Even our own governor, our former governor, Brian Kemp, he was an investor in extended stay motels. And it's full of Black folks who, we don't have project housing anymore, even though Atlanta was the birthplace of the first public housing development. It was also the first place where it was dismantled. So we do not have enough elected officials who believe in the investing in public goods. So homelessness is among its worst in Georgia than anywhere else in the country. So we have this dichotomy of Black progress and Black excellence, but also some of the worst economic conditions for Black people as well. And that's because we have not gotten at the root of the problem, and we're just dealing with the symptoms and moving it all around the city.
That's the voice of Malaika Jabali, the author of the book, No, It's Not You, It's Capitalism. We often say Black folks are the canary in the coal mine. And as you're talking about this income inequality of having billionaires and millionaires, the Tyler Perrys of the world, the Oprahs all up in Atlanta, and then you have this homelessness. It seems like that's always been a mainstay in America. And it's definitely, with the passage of this bill, something that should be quite apparent, you know, if not sooner than later, where we're going to see, you know, all the trimmings that we're supposed to be able to, that are within our fingertips, but are permanently out of reach, because we're always mired in debt, student loans, all these different types of things that trap us and keep us there for a very long time. With that being said, and building off the notion of this emotional, you know, relationship that we have with capitalism, what do you say to somebody like me who's like, you know, Malaika, if I get this $1 billion, if you let me go out and get this billion, I'm gonna come back and I'm gonna save the hood. I'm gonna buy up the projects. I'm gonna get you a job and everybody else around you. And so let me cook. Let me do these things. Because that's an attitude a lot of people have, versus sitting up there and like sharing resources and doing all the socialism stuff, which, you know, has been mystifying, in my opinion. But people have this in their head, like, I ain't trying to share my resources with you. Let me go get this money, then I'm going to come back and I'm going to be the benevolent capitalist. I'm going to be the benevolent billionaire. I'm going to be like Bill Gates, and I'm going to, you know, make it rain in the community. How do we respond to that? Because a lot of people think like that, even if in our presence, in your presence, they don't say it. But, you know, I'm trying to get this money and I'm going to make sure everybody eats. That's what I say I'm going to do.
I have multiple minds about that. I think, one, it is a good thing if people who are rich, and let's say that they didn't get their money through exploitation, because you can become, I mean, theoretically speaking, I think you can become a billionaire and not necessarily be that way because you exploited other people's labor. So let's, if you had some brilliant creative talent and all you did was tour, that is you. Let's, you know, I don't think there's any artist who has this example, but in theory, you just toured and you entertained people and you got $1 billion through that. And you decided to then give your money to people. Fine. I think that's fair. You do you. I think as long as you're not exploitative, you're not stealing people's labor, you're not lobbying the US government to make sure that workers aren't having adequate wages, you're not lobbying to make sure that we don't have adequate healthcare, you're paying your taxes. I think in a theoretical world, that could be possible. However, we are living in the real world of the United States of America, where if that were a sustainable way of going about this injustice, it would have happened already. And so my argument here is, so I said I have multiple minds about it. One is, in theory, it could work, maybe. But secondly, we haven't seen it. Thirdly, if we did see it, there still is the fundamental problem of capitalism, which is that it requires maximizing shareholder value. I studied corporate law. I went to law school. I practiced as an attorney. These are the things that we know it is required of corporations. If whatever you do that's benevolent does not also maximize shareholder value, you are not fulfilling your fiduciary duty as a person on this board, as a CEO, or whoever is responsible, who has those, you know, fiduciary duties to the company. As an owner of a company, you are not doing what you need to do for your shareholders, and you could get sued under corporate law in the United States. We are organized as a capitalist society. So whatever you might want to do individually, you are not even incentivized to do the right thing, and it could be illegal for you to do what you think is the right thing. So there is really no way to scale that up. Thinking in startup terms, there's no way to scale up your benevolent capitalism because it goes against the grain of what we have established in precedents from the Supreme Court on down through other federal courts. So barring, you know, the illegality for the systemic challenges, again, I just go back to, if we thought, specific to Black people, if we thought that Black capitalism would work, or if we believe that it can, where are the examples of that? So this book is arguing, why don't we just consider something else? We've been talking about Black capitalism for about 100 years, you know, since we have had
Days of Marcus Garvey.
Right, since we've had, thank you, Black Star, since we've been emancipated, we've been talking about this. Why hasn't it worked yet? Why haven't those capitalists come together and done all these things for the hood?
Because those people are greedy. But sister, if I get the $1 billion, if you let me do it, you know, then we're going to change. But then we also forget the other adage, more money, more problems.
Okay.
And there's all these different examples that, you know, you can write a whole book on it, that when people get all that money, a whole lot of other responsibilities pop up, a whole lot of other unforeseen circumstances, scenarios, and greed. You know, it's like, you know, when I had $10, I didn't mind giving you four, you know, five. I got $100 and I'm looking at you like, I don't know, if I give you that money, I might not get this 100 again. You know, so you want to hold on. It's like, dude, you're not going to be able to spend this all in a day, but I need to, you know, I got to, you know, something about once you get it, you want to hold on and never give it up. That's a hard emotional thing.
That's right. And I will never be in those kinds of circles and that mentality of people who become billionaires and just hold on to all their wealth. But there is a culture among the billionaire class where they do, I don't know what it is that makes them want to hoard that. Like, what is the psychology behind that? You know, I think that's another question. What is the psychology of saying, I need to keep up, you know, if somebody got $100 billion, then I need to get 150. What are you hoarding all of this for? I think it's fundamentally sick. Like, why do you need that?
The last poet used to call it the God complex. You know, I want to play God. I'm so bored. I nothing else to do. So now, you know, I'll give you a couple of dollars, Malika, if you go get me a cheesecake. You know, that type of thing. You know, we start
cross
doing
the Brooklyn Bridge to get
the Brooklyn Bridge, and you know, and next thing you know, we won't go down that road, but
we know what it is.
Yes. You know, getting us weaned off of capitalism, you know, really is essential to your book. And you have a number of chapters that kind of, you know, weigh in on this. A couple of things that stood out to me, and I don't know, I'm spoiler alert for the book. You have this notion about the sweet talk of capitalism. And then I wrote down here the graphic of the Johns. Can you explain that? You know, because you have John the planter, you know, John the factory worker, and it goes from John to Jason, you know.
Yes.
So you saw this evolution of the Johns, and I thought that was fascinating and something for us to definitely think about.
Yeah, we wanted it. So by we, I'm referring to my editor. We were like, how do we depict who a capitalist is? So demystify it. And they are actual people. And this, it was kind of a timeline. We wanted, it was sort of a cheeky way of describing the different types of capitalist bosses that have existed in modern society. So you had John, which is I assume a popular name from the 1800s, who was a planter. So they got their money by making sure that Black people were and other people were enslaved. And so that's how they got money. Throughout capitalism's history, we've never seen a time when it has not been exploitative. So each of these capitalist bosses, from John down to Jalen or whatever I call them, who is
Jason,
the tech giant,
yeah,
it depends on some form of exploitation. So that was the underlying idea, but we wanted to do it in a cheeky way with the evolution of white men's names, particularly.
So, I don't think it was cheeky at all. I think it was very effective. I was like, whoa. Okay. I never thought of it like that. That's, you know, you have John, the factory owner, John the third, you know, who's the private equity fund managing partner, and Jason, you know, the social media startup founder. And
right.
All three of these folk, I mean, all four of them, you know, there's a timeline. They've been there. They've been the manifestation of what you're saying we need to wean ourselves from.
Mm-hmm.
They just changed their name and have their look, you know.
That's right.
You know, different type of hustle, but it's still the same old game. And I was like, damn, that's right on. I better, you know, maybe abandon my billionaire dreams. I don't want to be a graphic in the next book.
I love that.
But you also talk about class distinctions as well, which is important. And I think this dives into some of the critique that we've had when we get folks that are talking about socialism and Marxism and, you know, and people walk away with the perception like it's a white thing because there's no Black faces. And there's oftentimes a criticism of folks who talk that and then leave out the analysis of race. That's been a critique of Bernie Sanders. Your godfather, Charles Barron, who we just had on, had that as a critique of the Democratic Socialists. You know, he was just on 2 weeks ago and said, we're the Black folks in this analysis. So can you break some this class distinction down and what we really need to glean from that?
It was practically impossible for me to write this book without centering racial exploitation, the way that capitalism has been implemented and grown and maintained in this country is by exploiting race, is by having racial constructions, is by creating a class of slave laborers, meaning Black people who were in many cases kidnapped and sold and trafficked here in the United States and throughout the diaspora to create this capitalist system, to create the industrial.
You froze. What happened?
Capitalism. We would not have had those manufacturing centers in England to then create a capitalist system without the cotton that our ancestors cultivated. It just would not, we don't have a world in which that exists. Maybe they would have found some other material in some other country somewhere, or it could have been right there in Europe, but it has been race-based because in order for capitalists to make money, they had to create a race of people to justify the depravity and the violence and the torture that we experience. So you had to create race to create capitalism. So there was no way of getting around that to me. So I think what happens is a lot of times when we talk about economic justice, we as Black people, we don't necessarily talk about the exploitative nature of capitalism and how it is rooted in our own dehumanization. It had to make us machines. It had to make us property. It had to make us a mode of production to survive. And unfortunately, in a lot of white leftist spaces, talking about race for them is uncomfortable. And to them, it makes it more difficult to build solidarity around workers' issues. But Black people are disproportionately many of the low-income workers that you want to organize. We are in the proletariat. So if you are not considering how capitalism has affected us in very unique ways, then it's going to be hard for you to pull together a effective cohort to challenge the capitalist system. And this is something that W.E.B. Du Bois said 100 years ago when he wrote Black Reconstruction. He talked about the fact that you had millions of an emancipated labor force who was practically ignored by white union organizers in the Northeast. When they were trying to challenge capitalism in these manufacturing centers, these burgeoning industrial centers in the United States, some of them not only were apathetic to these Black workers who were emancipated and who could be put into the fold, but they were antagonistic to abolition. They don't want us to compete for the labor of white workers. And so if there are these fault lines in the early history of labor organizing that we've continued to see right now, it's going to be really hard to organize a effective proletariat. So that was the idea of saying, okay, we got to know how to talk to Black people who are some of the most exploited workers. And we also, as Black people, have to recognize how capitalism is at the root of a lot of what we're experiencing.
You know, as you were talking, Malaika, I'm thinking it's an addiction that some people have. This, you know, when I'm playfully saying, let me cook, let me get that $1 billion, right? That's an addiction. Like, let me just get my hands on it. But I also think there's another addiction, like the addiction of not wanting to see us cook, literally be free, be at the table. Because as you're talking about the exploitation that we've gone through and you're looking at slavery, I'm just seeing it come up again in a new name, the whole prison industrial complex. You know, Black criminality, Black death is a $1 billion-a-year industry. Black hatred, you know, going to the startup companies and how much money do they make showing us fighting and doing all kind of crazy things, you know, and that can go viral. But if I say Free Palestine, we're shadow banned, right? So it seems like that's a hard habit for people to shake. The exploitation may be just seeing us in misery, you know, being as a form of entertainment and sitting there going, well, could be bad, but we ain't like them folks in the east side of town or the south side. And that seems to be a hard thing to shed. That's a relationship that might have to write a book. Can you shed anti-Blackness? You know,
it sounds like you're talking about that internalized anti-Blackness among our own people.
Well, we have it, but I'm saying this, I think when you have a refusal to talk about race and you come with the whole class thing and, you know, and you want to ignore something that is very fundamental to the pillars of this country, I say you have an addiction and you have an anti-Blackness that you don't want to shed. You might have nice words to say things, just like I may have nice words as a male to say about women, but I ain't trying to have you lead my church or, you know, sit next to me, you know what I'm saying? But I can say all the right things, you know, liberation for all, but come home and, you know, make my wife go make the dinner. So you didn't shed, you're not really liberatory at the end of the day. And this has been an age old battle on that left to really recognize race in a very fundamental way, that it seriously gets shed. And I think that plays a big role as to why we're still here, because you're not really going hard in the paint on it. You're going hard in the paint on class, but you ain't going where You ain't going where the real exploitation is at, and that's around race.
Mm.
End of story, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Just straight up racism.
Yeah.
One of the unfortunate, one of the many, to put it lightly, one of the incredibly insidious consequences of capitalism is the anti-blackness that
yeah.
was created for it to be created. And it has almost been given a life on its own in terms of the stereotypes around Black people. When you think about, you know, whether people even think we are worthy of saving, whether we are worthy of having policies geared towards us, whether we are worthy of campaigning for or thinking that we have enough value to try and appeal to us in campaigns or your policy agenda, there's just straight up racism.
I mean, look what's going on. Look what's going on in New York. Look what's going on in New York right now with this, with, you know, I like what he has to say, you know, Mandabi, if I might have mispronounced his name, in winning the Democratic thing. But the headlines everywhere is like, he won without the Black vote. This can become a formula of how you could do it, which means you don't have to deal with these Negroes again. You know, we found a way that you can win and don't have to have Dave and Malaika and all those people in the room talking that race stuff. And that is akin to the Democratic Party, you know, saying we need to get the proverbial white soccer mom. If we get that, we don't need anybody else. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's your downfall one way or the other.
I think it's extremely short-sighted to not want to appeal to every constituent of worker, you know, again, knowing that there are some, there are workers who are extremely conservative and the things that they value are probably not the things that we would want collectively. Mm-hmm. But barring that, most workers, they just want, they want a decent, affordable house to live in. They want the option probably of having affordable public housing or free public housing. They want to be able to have free healthcare like every industrial society. So there's a lot of ways that workers align. And with that, if you are almost deliberately excluding a whole class of that because you think you have whatever ideas about Black workers that that you might have, how are you truly a progressive candidate? And this is not applying, you know, this is not specific to the New York race, because I've got some kind of mixed, I've got very varied feelings about that. I think one person is a candidate, another one might be a strategy that his party, the you know, what DSA is doing, and I don't know how much they're completely in alignment with that that strategy, but it's short-sighted because the mayor is not the one who passes the budget. The city council passes the budget, and they're all elected by people. They're elected by constituents. So if you do not have enough Black people who are engaged in the electoral process, who are electing the people to the city council to then sign on to, or to, I have to say, to pass the budget that you are pushing for, you're going to have very limited success in some place like New York. I worked in the city council for many years of my that's the longest place that I've been, is in city government, specifically New York city government. And I saw how crucial the city council was to getting progressive policies enacted in the city, and not just policies, but I would say not just laws, not just legislation, but land use policy. What's being built and where? Who is creating luxury housing and how? Who is making sure that there is enough housing that meets the area median income, not to get too technical, but that meets the actual income of the people who live in that community? Council members decide that. So if you as a mayor are not responding to constituents who are then putting in office those elected officials, you're going to have limited utility for whatever agenda that you have.
Definitely something to keep in mind. All politics is local, even when it's micro-local, you know, city council versus mayor. As we close out, two or three chapters you want people to pay close attention to in your book?
Definitely. You know what? We're going to make it easy for people. I would say chapter one and chapter two. So each chapter, which is what I loved, is that I wanted it to have some pop culture reference, generally rom-coms or romantic kinds of references, just in keeping with the book. And so the first one lays out, well, why is capitalism a catfish? Why does it pretend to be one thing and then does something else? And how do we recognize that? And then the second one is on race and class. So I take a metaphor of, or the example of the Boy Is Mine, that song with Brandy and Monica, where they're fighting each other across this wall, at least in the music video, and they're not seeing the other person on the other side of the wall. And they're fighting over this man that is both doing them dirty. So capitalism is the man, and you know, we can gender however you want to, but it's just, this example was Brandy and Monica. And the man was doing them dirty. Capitalism does the same thing, but we are talking past each other through a wall. But then ultimately in the end, they realize they have more in common than not, and they kick him to the curb. So that was a metaphor for race and class and how we have been divided by these racial distinctions that are pure social constructions. And we're not really seeing where our alignment is, but there is possibility for us to find consensus and common ground because we're dealing with the same kinds of exploitation.
Well, there you have it. An excellent book. Again, the It's Not You, It's Capitalism by Malaika Jabali. Want to thank you for joining us this afternoon and, you know, talking us through some of the concepts. And, you know, you're going to have to write another book. You know that. Yeah, you're going to have to do another one.
I'm working on one. It's a different tenor, but similar themes.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to it. And thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Ralph for now. Peace.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop, EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim, yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone, Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out Anita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me, yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio,
kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Hey, yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
This is Bird Note. As a kid, science writer Ryan Mandelbaum avoided birds, thinking they were gross and kind of scary. But when working on an environmental project in journalism school, Ryan had a change of heart.
I just came across a story about how the New York City Audubon Society was painting lawn flamingos white to try and attract great egrets back to an island off the coast of Staten Island. And I just thought this was so funny, and I had to learn more.
That led to a video project and a quest to capture footage of a great blue heron, a bird that Ryan had never seen before, which was actually hard to find for a totally novice birder. But after a lot of trial and error, and with some help from the New York City Parks Department, they found one.
Just seeing this bird emerge from its nest, it was so much bigger than I thought it was going to be, and it was so much more majestic and beautiful than I thought it was going to be. And it was just this mind-blowing experience, like, oh my God, like, this bird lives in New York City.
Now, Ryan and their spouse go birding all the time, planning vacations around what birds they might see. Finches have taken the top spot as Ryan's favorite birds, but the heron has not been forgotten.
Great blue herons still evoke a sense of like excitement and almost nostalgia for my earlier days going birding.
For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements.